corporate America, in law enforcement, in the media, in the military, in politics, and in every other powerful institution in the USA. You simply cannot hold significant power in this country if you are out to hurt or are even insensitive to a specific racial or religious group. And if you don't believe me, ask Trent Lott. No, it's not racism, but cowardice that allows evil dope pushers to run wild in the Englewoods of this country. Few in power want to confront the problem because there's little in it for them. Unfortunately, many powerful people in America will do the right thing only if it will directly benefit themselves. Cleaning up drug trafficking in poor neighborhoods does not win elections, lead to high lecture fees, or excite public adulation. The street drug life is a tough, ingrained, unpleasant situation with racial overtones all day long. Few in power want to go near it. That's why there's no solution in sight. So, while overt racism is not the primary reason inner-city neighborhoods are neglected and overlooked, stealth racism is definitely in play in America. This is sneaky bigotry that sometimes unintentionally insults and demeans. Those who justified the prom situation are good examples of Americans embracing stealth racism, at least on that issue. Fortunately, stealth racism is mostly petty in its application, but it is harmful nonetheless to anyone who experiences it. However, here is truth number one if you are a minority American looking for a full shot at the pursuit of happiness. Don't sweat the small stuff. Ignorant behavior on the part of others often means nothing to your life. Overlook the insult, avoid the practitioner, and concentrate on doing constructive things that will make you a good person and a success in the workplace. I know it's easy for a guy like me to write that. I am not in your shoes, but this is solid advice. But what exactly is small stuff? Well, here's an example. A very successful black female broadcaster has been a friend of mine for some time now. Recently, she was shopping in an upscale store looking for luggage. She noticed a sales clerk watching her very closely. Of course, she was annoyed. Then the clerk came over and my friend asked to see a certain piece. She replied, "Oh, you know that's very expensive." Offensive? Sure. Racist? Possibly. Important? No. My friend just looked at the woman, rolled her eyes, and left the store. But that incident did upset her. I told her that was understandable, but not worth her time. Dumb people are dumb people. You have a choice. Ignore them or confront them. In this case, a cold stare was all the emotion wattage that person warranted. But let's go back to Englewood for a moment. Cops and prosecutors know it's impossible to enforce the law in any neighborhood if there's not cooperation between the people who live there and the authorities. In rich neighborhoods, most people love the police. They wave at them and smile and give them Christmas presents. All is fine between the police and the citizenry. Not so in the ghettos. Suspicion and animosity exist between the police and many poor people, and each side has valid reasons for the distrust. The cops know they are disliked, and they know the streets are dangerous. The folks know the police are sometimes resentful of the danger and hostility they face, and that resentment sometimes spills over into unpleasant confrontations, even with law-abiding citizens. Fear is present on both sides, and fear will always cause hostility. In the 1930s, my grandfather patrolled some tough, poor neighborhoods in Brooklyn, New York, and had some very unkind things to say about lawbreakers and those who enabled them. But my pop, as we called him, was willing to give up his life to protect an American of any color. He was no intellectual, but he was brave and honest. He could also be brutal and, at times, meted out street justice when he knew the guilty party would skate around the system and avoid punishment. My grandfather and his peers kept crime in the poor neighborhoods down by using a kind of low-grade vigilantism. Drug dealers were treated so harshly that they rarely appeared on my grandfather's beat for fear of him. Morphine addicts and street winos were also told to move on, and that's what they did if they wanted to avoid a measured dose of pain. The result was that in these working-class and poor Brooklyn neighborhoods, children could play unsupervised in the streets and women could walk with little fear to the markets and movies after dark. Those were the Depression days and nobody had much money, but everybody had the freedom to live and work in a protected environment. My grandfather took it personally if anyone on his beat got either assaulted physically or taken by a hustler. His network of informants would almost always pinpoint the guilty party. Pop and his co-workers took it from there. The word spread fast. Don't play illegal games in Flatbush. That kind of community policing rarely happens today, which is probably a good thing. My grandfather had too much power and too little supervision. He was a good man, but some of his cohorts were not. Corruption and shakedowns were common, and so was racial invective. Fascism always causes crime to fall, but the consequences are always frightening. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. The brutalizers can produce order, but they also always produce terror as well. Mussolini made the trains run on time in Italy, but his brown-shirted gang also could beat you to death for a misdemeanor. There is, however, a middle ground. The residents of Englewood and other crime-ridden neighborhoods will never rid themselves of degenerates until they decide to cooperate with the system, however flawed it may be. Anti-police minority leaders are not looking out for the folks. They are hurting the folks. No one can confront criminals effectively but the police. They are the only ones with the power to remove pernicious people from the sidewalk in front of your home. Hating the cops is not going to help you. Is this understood? It is self-defeating, it is unfair and dangerous to your children. The common sense response to a crime siege, whether you're a minority or not, is to deal with the police through the churches. Dropping a dime on a drug dealer is dangerous. But speaking privately to your minister or priest about threatening situations is usually safe. Every poor neighborhood in the USA should have a church council, a group of local clergy that meets police liaisons on a weekly basis. At those meetings, information would be passed along, dangerous situations discussed. Clergy of all religions must take it upon themselves to stand up for fearful Americans who need help. So why isn't this being done on a widespread basis all across the USA? Why haven't we heard Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton or the Rap Stars or La Raza or any other powerful minority voice propose this? Because the church police solution is exactly that, a solution. And demagogues don't want solutions, at least ones for which they cannot take credit. No, many of the powerful minority lobbyists want to stoke up the hate, keep the racial divisions going. This is their strategy to gain and hold power. Newsflash, it works. The racial demagogues have figured out that if there is no dragon, pressing problem, outrageous controversy, a white or black knight is not needed. And these demagogues want to control the dragon slaying agenda. They don't want racial problem solving done by others because that dilutes their power. As a result, a very few minority spokespeople push narrow, selfish agendas to the apathetic national media, which, you may have noticed, grants access to very few minorities. Thus, important work like protecting the good people of Englewood goes undone because there's no high-profile pressure to get anything changed. There is, of course, hope. Many local leaders in besieged neighborhoods are trying to improve things, but for real change to happen in chaotic neighborhoods, there must be rules, strict rules. There must be a code of conduct that is widely accepted in the inner cities, just as there is in the affluent suburbs. Here is a creed that might be a place to start. 1. Having a child out of wedlock would be considered a harmful thing, something to discourage. 2. Drug selling would be considered a violent crime, and those involved in this most harmful of enterprises would be shunned and reported to the authorities through the churches. 3. Drug addiction and alcoholism would be considered contagious diseases. Those afflicted would be encouraged to get help, but not looked upon as victims. 4. All kinds of child abuse and neglect would be confronted by the community immediately and reported to the proper authorities. There would be zero tolerance for adults who hurt or endanger children. 5. Police would be assigned to provide protection at all public schools and would be stationed on campus to deal with disruptive and destructive students. 6. Curfews on teenagers would be enacted and enforced by local communities. 7. Zoning laws would be toughened and standards of care imposed on properties, both public and private. Rundown buildings would be more easily condemned and then sold at auction to responsible builders. And 8, public nuisance laws would be passed so that individuals who disrespect neighborhoods and properties by actions such as graffiti, public lewdness and intoxication, incivility in words or deeds, littering, or the general creation of mayhem could be arrested and prosecuted by local authorities. If that creed was encouraged in all poor neighborhoods and a cooperative discipline imposed by responsible citizens, who of course are the majority in every neighborhood, you would see the ghettos of the country gradually transformed into solid working-class enclaves. But no such creed has been proposed by the minority national leadership. Without the kind of mass exposure and pressure those people can bring, things are likely to get worse in the chaotic districts. And that's good if you're a racial hustler who has accumulated power by blaming the white man for everything. The more devastation you can point to in the minority communities, the more disciples you can sign up. A prosperous population has no need of divisive demagogues. A desperate population is vulnerable to exploitation by them. Without a doubt, the number one problem among minority Americans is the collapse of the family. As I mentioned in Chapter 5, the rise in the percentage of children born out of wedlock has corresponded with the rise of secularism in America. There is no question about that. As late as the 1970s, there was a certain stigma imposed by society on a woman who got pregnant outside of marriage. No longer. Now it's baby on board, and if no father's around to support it, hey, it's none of our business. The hell it isn't. The epidemic of out-of-wedlock kids is the primary source of poverty and social problems in this country. We all pay for that. The statistics are brutal. As pointed out in Chapter 2, nearly 69% of African-American babies are now born to single mothers. For black women ages 15 to 24, that figure is an astounding 89%. That is simply a cultural collapse on an unprecedented scale for a developed country. Just the fact that nearly all black girls and young women having babies today are unmarried is enough to ensure social chaos within the African-American community for generations to come. A child without a secure support system will most likely be unable to compete with a child who has one. Thus, a cycle of hopelessness and deprivation will continue. So let me ask you this question. When was the last time you heard Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton or even Colin Powell address this issue? When was the last time the elite media pointed it out to you? When was the last time there was a rally in Washington demanding that this colossal problem be addressed by all Americans? Think about it. Trent Lott's foolish comments on race and segregation drew 1,000 times more attention than the virtual collapse of the family infrastructure in the African American community. And there's a definite reason for that. Are you ready for some tough truth? Here it comes. The true reason minority problems are not effectively dealt with in the mass media and among powerful politicians is that the racial witch hunters have hijacked all serious public policy debate by instilling a chilling fear into the national discourse. One dubious slip of the tongue can destroy a career, and all of us in the spotlight know it. Racial witch hunters are people who devote their lives to finding offense and then labeling the offender a racist. There are also ethnic, religious, and sexual witch hunters, all of whom do exactly the same thing, with only the adjectives changing. Make one comment that can be construed as anti-minority, and the witch hunters fire up their torches and launch their mission to destroy your reputation. If you don't believe me, ask Mr. Lott, Senator Rick Santorum, Dr. Laura, Pat Buchanan, and dozens of other public figures who have run afoul of the politically correct demonizers. Here's how the witch hunting process works, and the simplicity of it would make the 17th century Salem murderers smile. First, a report surfaces, often in a gossip column, that some well-known person said something untoward. Many gossip columnists operate on the fringe of journalism, using anonymous sources and innuendo to fill their columns with titillating items designed to prick the famous. Liz Smith is an exception, but the American gossip industry is generally ruthlessly irresponsible and protected by libel laws so loose they give a public person little, if any, recourse. After the gossip item is published, the special interest websites pick it up. Anger and angst are then generated among their readers, many of whom revel in this kind of stuff and could not care less about the truth. The internet crowd blasts the libel all over the chat rooms, and bingo, it surfaces as fact in mainstream national publications. The tragedy is that far too many minority Americans buy into this spectacle and enjoy the witch hunting that results. The downside is that problems go unsolved and unaddressed. In our super-sensitive society, offense is taken so easily that honest discussion of most controversial issues is virtually non-existent, especially in the hallways of power. If there is absolutely any chance that a point of view can be twisted into a supposed ethnic insult, that point of view will not be uttered. This is why the Mexican border situation has been allowed to rage out of control, and also why crime in the inner cities remains rampant. The powerful people who could tackle serious problems often pass on any subject that might possibly catch the eyes of the witch hunters. I know this from personal experience. You may remember that I attacked the gangsta rap industry, including the rantings of white rapper Eminem, for selling mind poison to impressionable kids. The rappers couldn't win the debate because much of their stuff is so antisocial, it's impossible to defend. So they tried to hang a racist tag on me. Didn't work because most black Americans realize this garbage is destructive and hateful, but the witch hunters tried. That battle was noticed by the press. In April 2003, a witch hunting play was manufactured by a vicious gossip writer in the Washington Post. The factor had just come off a huge win with its coverage of the war, and some in the elite media were bitter and ready to rumble, especially because, as I mentioned earlier, I had embarrassed some print journalists. For years, I have been supporting a charity called the Best Friends Foundation, a mentoring group that helps poor black kids around the country by matching them up with professional Americans who provide guidance and emotional support on a one-on-one basis. I believe this program and others like it are the keys to leveling the playing field somewhat for children who do not have strong support systems at home. On Saturday, April 12, 2003, I emcee the annual Best Friends fundraiser at the Marriott Wardman Park Hotel in Washington, D.C. There were more than 700 people in the ballroom, and close to $1 million was raised. The theme was a sock hop, a 60s-type rock show featuring the Supremes, Bobby V, and Paul Revere, and the Raiders. As part of my duties, I was asked to introduce some kids who would sing and dance before the professional performers came on. One of the groups was called the Iron Men, a bunch of boys in their early teens. One problem. The Iron Men weren't ready when they were summoned to the stage. So I went off into a riff to kill time until they showed up. I used my Bill Murray voice, and this is exactly what I said. Where are the Iron Men? Are they in the Iron Man bathroom? If so, get out here, you guys. Geez, I hope they're not in the parking lot stealing hubcaps, an ironic throwback reference as the hubcap flinching was big in the American Graffiti days. Bring on the Iron Men. Suddenly, they came running out to amused, enthusiastic applause and did their number. Now, I know the evening was a great success because everybody I encountered had a great time. I felt good about the whole deal. 2 days later, all that changed. Lloyd Grove, a gossip columnist for the Washington Post, is, in my opinion, a despicable human being. He makes his living hurting people and seems to have it in for the Fox News Channel. In the spring of 2003, Grove had to retract an item he wrote about Roger Ailes, the boss of Fox News. In that item, Grove called Ailes an advisor to President Bush, knowing that such a label would ruin Roger's reputation for objectivity. Grove's boss got a missive from the Fox legal department, and the next day, he retracted the item, saying he had gone too far. But before that episode, Grove zeroed in on me and wrote that I had made a, quote, racially insensitive remark, unquote, at the Best Friends benefit. Apparently, Grove called Elaine Bennett, the president of Best Friends, asking about the hubcap remark. Miss Bennett told Grove that absolutely nothing offensive took place, and the evening was a smashing success. She then called me and to tell what was going on. I was stunned. I called Grove and told him the whole thing was ridiculous. The next day, he wrote this in the Washington Post. The unfunny factor. Maybe Bill O'Reilly should declare a no-quip zone. I'm seeing Saturday night's Best Friends Rock and Roll Gala, The Fox News Channel star was trying to fill dead air during a lull in the entertainment. O'Reilly ad-libbed, "Does anyone know where the best men Iron Men are? I hope they're not out in the parking lot stealing hubcaps." To say that this conservative audience, dominated by many of Mr. O'Reilly's biggest fans, was aghast is an understatement. One attendee emailed us asking for anonymity. The well-known Republican politicians and their spouses seated at or near my table were appalled. Unquote. Oh yeah? Then why couldn't Grove get one person to go on the record? Remember, there were more than 700 people in a room, many of whom were black. No one complained to me or to any member of the Best Friends board. In fact, no one even knew what Grove was referring to until more than 48 hours after the event. And why would anyone need anonymity? If I had done something offensive, wouldn't somebody have been outraged enough to step up? Who am I, Don Corleone? In reply to that vicious column, Elaine Bennett issued this statement, quote, "Bill O'Reilly has generously supported the Best Friends Foundation, specifically our Best Men program for boys. He wrote a check that sent Best Men boys to summer camp. He made an offhand comment that was a New York-style Fonzie throwaway line. We were very grateful that Bill O'Reilly took time from his family to donate his services to a worthy cause. We would be happy to welcome him back next year," unquote. Now, I felt very bad that Elaine Bennett had to waste her time defending me, but she's a stand-up woman, and she nailed the entire debacle when she said to me, quote, "Grove took what was a great evening and turned it into something negative," unquote. But that's what Lloyd Grove and the other witch hunters do. They point fingers, ruin reputations, and feel darn good doing it. Predictably, Grove's dishonest column hit the special interest websites, and Fox received the usual hue and cry demanding an apology. Grove himself appeared on MSNBC to lament the insensitivity of it all. Fanning the racial flames, he shook his head sadly at the boorishness of O'Reilly. And then, guess what? Newsweek magazine, which is owned by the Washington Post, reprinted Grove's out-of-context quote. A perfect trifecta. The witch hunters were delirious. Fortunately, I have a forum where I can strike back. Fox lawyers immediately contacted the CEO of Post Newsweek to point out that Grove's campaign was false and malicious. I had made no racially insensitive remarks, and to continue claiming otherwise could lead to legal action. I would have made that hubcap remark to any kid with whom I was joshing around. I treat all kids the same. I don't care what color they are. Try and make a racial incident out of a simple jest is flat out evil. The anger I feel for the witch hunters of America is off the charts. They come in every shape and color. The Catholic League of America issued a press release after my criticism of the Pope, charging that I despised him. In a Factor segment about the Border Patrol, I asked what the slang was for illegal Mexican nationals and the smugglers who lead them into the USA. The words are wetback and coyote. The next day, some whacked-out website said I called Mexicans wetbacks. The hits just keep on coming. The tragedy here is that the minority community in this country will never get the attention and resources it deserves until this kind of stuff is condemned by minority Americans themselves. As I argue, the white majority is so afraid of being labeled and branded by the witch hunters and racial demagogues that they often disengage from the hard analysis that can solve problems. Gay Americans should also take note. Although there are homophobes running around, not every criticism of gays is driven by prejudice. The antics of some irresponsible homosexuals can and should be scrutinized. The out-of-control guy who luridly flaunts his homosexuality in front of children should be criticized by all Americans, including gays. Bad conduct is bad conduct. Being a minority is not an excuse. In the end, Americans will never come together and work out stubborn problems and attitudes if the witch hunters are not taken down. Right now, fear dominates the discussion, and the bad guys are running wild. How many other TV news programs besides The Factor cover minority issues? How many politicians do anything more than spout platitudes? No matter what, I will not surrender to the witch hunters and the demagogues, because they are not looking out for anyone. They are haters. I decided this in 1975. The first major news story that I ever covered was the busing controversy in South Boston. A federal judge named Garrity, in an ill-conceived attempt at integration, forced little black kids to get on buses and attend school in the all-white ethnic enclave of South Boston. I saw my own people, working-class Irish Americans, curse these young children and threaten them with harm. I saw the frightened faces of the kids and the tears in their eyes. It broke my heart. I vowed way back then that if I could right some wrongs with my reporting, that I would do so. I think I've stuck to that vow. But 28 years later, it is still a much tougher road for minorities in America than for us whites. Although incomes for black American couples in stable relationships are almost on a par with whites, the amount of grief minorities have to deal with is still far too high. But I believe most Americans are fair people. They will try to help their fellow citizens if they believe that help will be accepted in good faith. The challenge for minorities is to reject the false prophets, the racial instigators, and the phony patronizers. The system is now in place for every American to succeed if the rules of hard work, honesty, and persistence are followed. To all minority Americans, I say, don't let the white proms and the store insults affect you. Don't be misled by the haters, and above all, don't join the witch hunters. There are people who want to look out for you, and many of them are members of the majority. They are worth seeking out. Chapter 9, Errors in Judgment. Ain't That America Something to See? Ain't That America Home of the Free? John Cougar Mellencamp, Pink Houses. There are a few countries in the world where a guy like me, who started out with absolutely no contacts or powerful mentors, can put together a career that results in fame, influence, and financial security. In most places, it simply cannot be done. And even in the USA, it's rare. But obviously, it is possible, and I am proof positive of that. So why did this happen for me? Well, among other things, I finally learned to look out for myself. Not by employing the foolish tactics of the selfish, but by mastering the art of self-protection in the pursuit of goals outside my own wants and needs. My success is built on three foundations: personal discipline, education, and persistence. As I've written before, I am not a natural television performer. In fact, it took me years to master the skill of speaking naturally before a camera. On the other hand, I was born with verbal and writing abilities, but they lay dormant until my mid-20s, undiscovered because no one in my life ever imagined I could make a living using them. Dissatisfied with the conventional options open to me, like teaching or law school, I pinpointed my natural abilities and figured out how to market them. Along the way, there was much trial and error, but you can do the same thing I did. Nor does it matter how old you are. We are all born with natural talent, but we must tap into it with a vengeance in order to reach our full potential. Here's a no-spin secret. The people you see leading the country, appearing in the media, acting on TV or in the movies, or doing anything that separates them from the crowd are usually just like you and me. I know many of them. I once sat in awe of them too. But when I finally met them up close and personal, the awe evaporated and reality set in. The so-called stars have the same kinds of problems the rest of us have. There's no magic that elevates their lives. They slog through the day just like we do, albeit with the help of publicists and hired gophers. But at night, they have to shut their own eyes and dream their own dreams. In my business, TV News, I know all the big shots, with the possible exception of Mike Wallace, who was a walking miracle. The others are simply highly skilled, highly driven men and women who capitalized on their opportunities. Brokaw, Rather, Jennings, Walters, Sawyer, Koppel, they're all very smart, but they are not geniuses, nor are they the beneficiaries of any extraordinary luck. They all just worked their butts off to succeed. Throughout my television career, I never pandered to my superiors or anybody else, and this resulted in much short-term pain, but even greater long-term gain. Also, I'm ambitious, but never at the expense of my dignity. I never compromised my principles or stabbed anyone in the back. But here's the truly shocking truth about my success. I made so many stupid mistakes that I'd have to write 3 books to chronicle them. So in the next few pages, I'll tell you about what I did that you should never do. In other words, this chapter is about how to look out for yourself. We'll begin with the O'Reilly theory of failure. Chaos always creates more chaos. Repeat, chaos always creates more chaos. Make that the mantra in your life, and it will save you much heartache and failure. Think about it in your own terms and on your own turf. I'll bet most of the disasters that have happened to you were at least in part brought upon by your own poor decisions. If you marry a screwed up person, chaos will follow. If you allow your kids to rule the house, the environment will become unbearable. If you fail to perform well at work, you will either lose your job or be made miserable by teed-off coworkers. The list goes on and on. The antidote to chaos? Personal discipline. The ability to do the right thing most of the time will make you successful. But in addition to developing discipline, you need to keep your personal mistakes to a minimum. There is nothing more difficult in life to accomplish. My mistakes usually were caused by a congenital impatience, insecurity, and an inability to control myself when confronted with the actions of bad people. Very often, I gave my enemies all they needed to defeat me. They didn't even have to break a sweat. At the same time, I made very few mistakes in my personal life. I have both the ability to recognize toxic people almost immediately, and also the discipline to avoid them in most cases, the theme we discussed at the start of the book. I never allowed an emotionally unstable person to exploit me or lead me into destructive behavior. I was single by choice for decades and always chose my girlfriends carefully, treating them with respect even when things weren't going well. I took responsibility for my behavior and tried not to do anything that I thought would be harmful to me or her. And I was sober all the time. The result was very few dramas in my personal life and a long list of great friends, both female and male. I'm sure I disappointed some people along the way, but I tried hard to be upfront and non-exploitative. I had no need for Dr. Phil, and thank God for that. Professionally, well, that's another matter. We all make mistakes as kids, but once you reach age 25, you had better start to wise up. That's the age I began working at WFAA-TV in Dallas, and I was anything but wise. Previously, my experiences in journalism at Boston University, where I earned a master's degree, and at WNEP-TV in Scranton, Pennsylvania, as a rookie reporter, were generally successful. I learned the basics of my craft and did well. But WFAA was a big-time Texas TV station with all the hyper-competitive garbage that goes along with that kind of territory. Simply put, nobody was looking out for me in the workplace, and many wanted me, a cocky Yankee, to fail dismally. So I was immediately put on the defensive, and my mistakes came fast and furious. When a surly but powerful anchorman sneered at my clothing, I told him to F off. When the office politicking assignment editor would send me on stories he knew were inconsequential, I would march into his office and demand an explanation. When a woman with minimal experience was hired to read the news, I asked why. Are you getting the picture? They disliked me at WFAA, and I not only failed to win them over, I gave them the middle digit, and I had to see these people every day. My major weak point was insecurity. Behind my bravado, I wasn't sure if I was skilled enough to make it in television news. When I arrived in Dallas, I had been in the business for less than a year, and I was still trying to prove myself to myself. Thus, any criticism leveled at me stung so much that I would lash out at the messenger. Besides, I was smart enough to recognize that most of the scrutiny coming my way was mean-spirited, designed to demean me, so I fought back. Trouble was, I had no weapons. Since that kind of situation is hardly unique to television news, you probably have experienced similar scenarios. Being pushed around while your legs are unsteady is painful, and one of the few things a person can do to relieve that pain is to talk about it with someone who is looking out for you. But I knew no one in Dallas. I had no confidants. That's when I made big mistake number one in my career. I confided in a sportscaster at the station. In hindsight, I was an idiot. This guy was scum. Everybody knew it but me. And did I ever shoot my mouth off to him, blasting others at the station who had offended me? Of course, everything I said caromed right back to the people I was lambasting. I got scorched by this guy, but I deserved it for being a fool. The result, of course, was chaos. Almost everyone at WFAA hated me, and I was constantly under fire. To this day, some of the people I work with in Dallas almost 30 years ago blast me whenever they can. These are generally bad people, but that's not the point. I had no idea how to deal with them, and they figuratively beat the living daylights out of me. It took me years to learn that talking about other people in the workplace is insane. Just don't do it. It's immature, it doesn't solve anything, and will most always reflect poorly on you. If you don't like somebody, avoid them or confront them, always in front of witnesses, by the way. Don't bring in an unrelated third party unless it's the human resources division of the company, and make damn sure the situation is unfixable before you do that. My mistake in Dallas was not caused by malice on my part. It was born out of frustration and immaturity. But my enemies there crushed me, and I supplied the boulders. What saved me professionally was that I performed well. I scored some touchdowns in the world of journalism. The more poorly I was treated, the more ferociously I attacked the job. I was going to show them. And many times I did. But because of the brutal mistakes I was making in the office, my career was much harder than it should have been. If I had just shut up off camera, my life would have been a lot easier. One caveat here. You can't allow yourself to be a doormat. Sometimes you have to fight the louts. But remember this, to win the fight, you have to have allies. You must build some sort of coalition. I did not. And that leads me to my second biggest mistake. I was always a guy who got angry about injustice, whether social or personal. As mentioned, the best reporters and analysts are the ones who try to right wrongs. That's me. And my social conscience is a big plus in my work. My passionate crusading set me apart from the usual TV automatons. But again, off camera, I took major hits trying to force fair play in the workplace. In 1981, I went to work for CBS News and got royally hosed by Dan Rather and his Merry Men. I write about it in my book, The No Spin Zone, if you want the gory details. But the point is that I tried to convince CBS News that it had an unfair system in place for the majority of its correspondents. That was like trying to convince Fidel Castro to be nicer to Cuban dissidents. Once again, I did all the wrong things at CBS News. After coming off a good run at WCBS-TV, the local New York City station, I was way too cocky, and my high opinion of myself was not shared by most of those working at the national level for CBS. They wanted me to toe the company line. You do what we tell you to do when we tell you to do it. I have never been particularly fond of that line. In network news, there is a term called bigfooting, which means that a more experienced or well-known reporter is allowed to take the work of another reporter and broadcast it. This is wrong. When I was bigfooted in Argentina during the Falkland Island War, I instantly rebelled. A number of old CBS hands told me to let it go and be patient. But I couldn't discipline myself. I hit the CBS News brass head-on, telling them they were morally wrong to allow the theft of one's work. Their reaction was to make an example of me by assigning me to the dismal overnight shift. The janitors and I had a great time at the CBS Broadcast Center on 57th Street in New York City. Again, since I had no chance of winning the fight with the CBS brass, it was just plain stupid of me to mount a light brigade-like charge. It got me deep-sixed at the national news level, a stigma it took me years to overcome. That incident caused me more pain than anything else in my career because I knew I was good enough to report for Dan Rather. But CBS put out the word that I couldn't hack it. With an ego like mine, that kind of rap cut deep. 5 years later, I got a chance to write the record at ABC News, and I did. I still didn't let the evil people push me around, but I had an ally in Peter Jennings. He looked out for me, and that made all the difference. You see, for a very long time, in addition to being impatient, immature, and impulsive, I was clueless in the ways of social intercourse in the workplace. I was a go-it-alone type guy, a high plains drifter who felt no need for support. I could make it by myself, I thought. Because of my upbringing, I did look out for others, but never tried to find people who would look out for me. That was an enormous mistake. I finally began to wise up about 7 years into my career when Jeff Schiffman, my former boss at WCBS, saved me after the CBS News debacle. After hearing about my travesty with the network, he hired me to anchor the news in Boston, where he had become a program director at the local CBS station there. Schiffman is from the Bronx and doesn't buy into the corporate mentality that individuality is something to be feared. In short, he liked my street savvy and my colorful style. He literally saved my career. Without him, I would not have succeeded, and you would not be hearing these words today. While working with him in Boston, it dawned on me that for some reason, Jeff Schiffman was looking out for me. He really helped me when most others would not. From that time on, I began to cultivate a support system. But it was a two-way street. Once I felt that a person was looking out for me, I became a soldier in their Praetorian Guard. Ask anyone who knows me. I am as loyal as I am annoying. Anyway, that was the turning point in my professional life. By learning how to find colleagues who would look out for me, I began learning how to look out for myself. I started to develop a posse, a group of people I could call for advice and perspective. I became interested in cultivating the friendship of quality people, and that has greatly enriched my life as well as enhanced my career. My third and final major mistake, up until this point anyway, was to fail to anticipate what could happen in important situations. Now, I pride myself on being perceptive and accurately evaluating people. In college, I love reading the Sherlock Holmes stories because of the fictional detective's observational gifts. It's a great skill to have, and I developed my own version of it. But I left out one very important ingredient. I often became intellectually lazy. While I saw events and people clearly, I did not carry that vision to the next step. I did not stay alert for possible betrayal, and I got hurt. Here's a good example of my intellectual laziness. From 1989 to 95, I anchored a syndicated television program called Inside Edition, one of those tabloid infotainment shows, but a good one. We routinely broke national stories of importance, and the networks copied our style in designing Dateline, Primetime Live, and 48 Hours. I had just come off three successful years as an ABC News correspondent, but knew that I had to get some national anchor experience if I wanted to take the next step and acquire some power in the industry. Unfortunately, that was not going to happen at ABC News. Although I was considered to be a solid reporter by the company, names like Stone Phillips and Forrest Sawyer, guys around my own age, were getting most of the meaningful substitute anchor work. So when Inside Edition offered to double my salary and appoint me senior correspondent and exclusive substitute on the anchor desk, I left ABC for the money-driven world of syndicated television. Peter Jennings told me to my face that I was crazy, and he was probably right. Inside Edition eventually became an enormous hit that made its owner, King World, tens of millions of dollars. But the people who ran that company had never wanted me as the anchor man. I got the job by default when Sir David Frost, the original anchor, was fired 3 weeks into Inside Edition's first year on the air. The ratings were collapsing and King World executives were looking at a disaster of enormous proportion. Syndicated television is even more brutal than network news, if that's possible. David Frost quickly felt the sting of that brutality and was sent back to London in a hurry. The King World press release said something about Sir David doing globe-trotting reporting for Inside Edition. The truth was that the company tossed him out on his knighted posterior, and I got the call from the bullpen, primarily because I was the only one in the building who could anchor the darn show. Assuming all the writing duties, I instituted a sharp editorial focus that emphasized crusading for justice instead of gratuitous sex and violence. With the help of producers John Tomlin and Bob Young, Inside Edition quickly turned around and began rocketing in the ratings. Sorry if that statement doesn't sound humble, but it's the truth. The three of us took a shambles and turned it into television gold. But that wasn't good enough because I didn't take care to look out for myself. I was too busy trying to beat a current affair and hard copy in the ratings, and we did. But along the way, I got mentally flabby and stopped anticipating what might happen in the vicious world of big-time television. There was never an easy month at Inside Edition. King World was constantly giving me a hard time over things like first-class airline travel, a decent publicist, perks that were given on most other national programs. They wanted a so-called big name to anchor the program. So at various times, the company offered my job to Mary Hart, Maury Povich, just about everybody else in TV who could sit up straight for a half an hour. My agents and I knew what was happening, but where else was I going to make the kind of money that I was making and have that kind of daily exposure? So I endured it for 5 years. But in July 1994, I said enough. My agent, Carol Cooper, went to King World and told him that I wanted Inside Edition to change into a harder edge program with a social message. I wanted the show to take on a crusading tone and bring down some bad guys, much like The Factor does now. Since the network primetime magazines were doing what we were doing and had the personnel to do it better, I felt that Inside Edition's days of prosperity were numbered unless we changed the format. I wanted to confront wrongdoing. King World wanted no part of that scenario. So on my instructions, my agent told King World that I would not be re-signing when my contract was up the following March and asked if, in the meantime, we could look around for other TV opportunities. Because I was under contract, I needed permission to talk with other broadcast companies. King World came back and asked if we would keep our intentions quiet because some of the stations might be upset if I left the program and the company wanted time to coordinate any anchor change. I agreed not to send out feelers for a new job. Big, big mistake, and it was entirely my fault. I knew how ruthless King World was, and I fully realized they cared not a fig for me. I should have demanded the company draw up a document praising my contributions and all that stuff in return for keeping my future intentions quiet. Such letters are an important part of one's resume in television, but I never even thought of it because I was not really looking out for myself. I was strutting around. I was even cockier than usual, if you can believe it, because the success of Inside Edition had dulled my instincts. I didn't even consider what this company might do to me. I was a sap. In October, I flew to Los Angeles to deliver a speech before hundreds of TV executives who had bought Inside Edition for their stations. The speech was a success, but immediately after it, producer John Tomlin pulled me aside and told me to call my agent right away. The words right away are never good in the TV industry. Something very bad was about to happen. Within the space of an hour, I found out that King World had hired Deborah Norville, who once had a short run on the Today Show, to replace me. And not only that, the company had told a TV writer that it had fired me. 5 years of hard work, a huge rating success, and I was fired? My surprise quickly turned to anger and then boiled over into outright rage when I read the story in the New York Post the next day. I was powerless to contradict the lie. But then John Tomlin stepped up and told a New York Daily News reporter the truth, that I had effectively resigned in July. The correct story was printed the next day. Tomlin had looked out for me, saving me a tremendous amount of heartache as well as keeping my career afloat. Getting fired is not the way to TV success. At last, I learned a very valuable lesson. In all important situations, you must stay vigilant. You must anticipate what could happen and take steps to prevent any dastardly deeds that may be headed your way. In hindsight, I should have never granted King World the time to do an end run. I should have negotiated the exact details of my departure, especially since I was doing them a favor by not publicly announcing my intention to move on. And here's the kicker. Even after this debacle, King World would not release me from my contract. I had to continue anchoring Inside Edition for 6 more months after the company stabbed me in the back. Can you believe it? Norville was pregnant, and they didn't want to put her on the air until after she delivered. So I walked in every day, did my job, and went home with a heavy paycheck. I never could have done that earlier in my career. The Dallas-era O'Reilly would have punched somebody out. But finally, I had developed some discipline. And shortly after I departed, karma did kick in. Inside Edition quickly lost ratings and influence, and Michael King, the company president, and in my opinion a true villain, was forced out of his own company when King World was bought by Viacom. So there. Trust me when I tell you that it is truly a miracle I am where I am in this world, with all the boneheaded mistakes I have made along the way. As I said, I could fill 3 books with them. But what's important for me and for you is to learn from self-imposed debacles. And I finally did, by learning how to look out for myself with the help of trusted advisors. And this necessary skill is critical in other aspects of your life, not just your career. Most Americans, I believe, make most of their mistakes not in the workplace, but in their personal lives. And those are even more devastating. The divorce rate in America hovers around 50%, and chaotic lives are on display every day, everywhere. Nobody gets away unscathed in a personal arena. At one time or another, we are all victimized. But you can cut down on personal pain if you simply follow your instincts and not your heart. Repeat, go with what you know, not what you feel. Here's what I mean. Most of us become infatuated with certain people over the course of our lives. Once in a while, that passionate feeling works out, but much of the time, it does not. Infatuation is always temporary, often based on nothing other than powerful physical attraction. Unfortunately, that kind of attraction makes us do things we would not ordinarily do. I was once infatuated with a woman who was the poster girl for venality. This woman was so selfish, she made Leona Helmsley look like Edith Bunker. She was off the charts manipulative and didn't even try to fake that she wasn't. She was so good looking, she knew she could con men into pretty much giving her anything she wanted. I actually thought I could change this woman. That was insane. She was disrespectful to pretty much everybody, including her own parents, and openly mocked some people she had screwed over. One time she hid behind her answering machine as an old boyfriend asked her for a callback. She snorted derisively, even though she had gone out with the guy for years. I told her flat out that she was engaging in disgraceful behavior, but even though I knew the woman was a block of ice, I did not disengage. Looking back, she should have been lodging at the Playboy Mansion, not hanging around with me. The good news is that I did not alter my behavior. I associated with the woman, but kept my defenses up and my actions under control. Finally, I wised up and told her I had better things to do with my life. However, I wasted an enormous amount of time and energy dealing with the lady on mostly her terms. So if this can happen to me, a rather hard-edged, no-nonsense kind of guy, then it can happen to anyone. The solution to toxic people is simple but difficult. You must divert yourself away from them. Once again, it comes down to discipline. If the fruit tastes good, but you bleed after eating it, you've got to dine elsewhere or be drained all the time. What society really needs is a 12-step program for infatuated Americans. This organization would supply wise counselors when we are tempted to associate with those who would do us harm, but look so good doing it. I'm not kidding. If you can get somebody to come over and talk you out of making that stupid phone call to that dangerous person, do it. Then immediately go out and have some fun. You can have plenty of good people in your life, but one emotional partner who is pernicious can negate them all. Remember, chaos always breeds more chaos. If a romantic partner or even a family member is causing you consistent and unnecessary pain, get out and stay out. The short-term feeling of loss is nothing compared to the damage that a truly bad or weak person can do to your life. You must see people as they are, not as you want them to be. You are not going to change a callous, cruel, selfish person. If you do hook up with Dr. or Ms. Evil, don't blame me. I've told you the truth. You can't change them. Some people are bad to the bone, and there's nothing anybody but the authorities can do. Learn it, live it, and spread the word. By avoiding hurtful people, you are indeed looking out for yourself, but again, not in a selfish way. The looking out for you number one philosophy usually involves screwing somebody over. The looking out for yourself philosophy makes you a more effective person, better able to help others and contribute to this world. And trying to make the world a better place is, of course, why you are here in the first place, despite what the greed is good crowd will tell you. They are a craven, decadent bunch. Avoid them and prosper. Embrace them and suffer. Finally, the media these days are enthralled with the words roadmap, as in President Bush's roadmap to the Middle East peace. Another silly press cliche, but the concept of positive direction is imperative in order to have a good life. And so we will map that out in the final chapter of this book. Chapter 10, here's to you. So let us stop talking falsely now, the hour's getting late. Bob Dylan, All Along the Watchtower. Most people will not tell you the truth. Why should they? Confrontation is a hassle, and many of us tend to shoot the messenger when the news is bad. So don't expect candor, not even from those who are looking out for you. Honesty may be the best policy, but keeping one's mouth shut is the rule of the day. For that reason, self-awareness is a must for those of us who want to fulfill our potential. Honest self-examination should be a part of our daily routine. We all make mistakes, but as we've discussed, the folks who make the fewest errors usually wind up the happiest. And there's one important corollary to self-awareness. When you do make a mistake, don't beat yourself up. I used to do that all the time. I specialized in brooding whenever I did something stupid. That meant in my younger days that I was brooding quite often. I developed moping into an art form. If you are going to live a truly productive life, you have to forgive yourself. The pop psych expression for the opposite is carrying baggage. That's another dumb cliche. But the point is that failing to recognize and accept your fallibility will lead to unhappiness. It is self-destructive to make a habit of harboring anger toward yourself. Moreover, carrying around your mistakes in an emotional knapsack will make you boring and unpleasant. Drop the guilt and strive to improve. That takes mental discipline and self-understanding. How many people do you know who are clueless about their own behavior? Legions, I bet. But not around me. I'm the type of guy who tells people to knock it off when they become annoying. But as I stated at the top of this chapter, most folks will not do that. They'll just avoid you instead. Let me give you a vivid example of how clueless some people are. These days, going to the movies where I live costs $10. So one night I'm sitting there during the coming attractions, and this guy behind me is talking on his cell phone. I'm sure you've experienced this kind of behavior. It's the screw you, I'll do whatever I want kind of attitude. Anyway, I turn around and stare at the guy. He keeps talking. Then I get up, all 6'4" of me, and say in a loud voice, "Hang that phone up or I'll take it away from you." The guy hung up. The theater crowd applauded. He should have been humiliated, but he probably wasn't. He most likely resented me for insisting on proper etiquette, but he didn't phone anyone right then to complain about it. People like that are, unfortunately, everywhere. They probably have been poorly raised and cannot think of anyone but themselves. Combine that state of mind with poor education and you have a potential criminal. That's how it happens. The mind is not only a terrible thing to waste, it is also your ticket to success or failure in this life. If you never learn how to think, if you drop out of high school, if you refuse to develop your intellect by reading and engaging in serious discussions, then you will not be able to compete in modern America unless you're lucky enough to become a rap star. I see kids all the time who are just about doomed by age 16 because they don't know anything. And worse yet, they don't want to know anything. Take your mind to the mental gym every day of your life. Read and think over and over and over. It is the most important thing you can do for yourself. Then there's your body to attend to. We all get one, and most of us abuse the heck out of it. Why? What is this all about? We pour intoxicating pollutants into our bodies. We pierce and tattoo them. We gorge on terrible food, and then don't go to the doctor to gauge the damage. This is insane. The average American alive today will live into his or her 70s. That's not a long time, except to teenagers. So, from the get-go, we should be trying to maximize our time on Earth. That means staying healthy. I'm simply astounded by people who smoke, drink heavily, and ingest narcotics. Millions of us are abusing the one thing we have some control over. God, or nature for you atheists, gives you a body, a mind, and a free will. He expects you to protect the franchise. But most of us don't. You can read nutrition and fitness books for a body primer, but remember this. Nobody can look out for you if you are a physical wreck. If you are grossly overweight or underweight, don't bathe regularly, refuse to go to the dentist, or do a myriad of other things that will hurt your body, no one can do anything for you. You will, inevitably, pay a painful price. Only the calendar date when disease pays you a visit is up in the air. So, here are the looking out for you rules, number one and number two. Develop your mind and respect your body. Now that we've settled that, I want you to meet two very powerful forces, independence and tolerance. Become acquainted with them and you will attract smart and caring people into your life. Independence, which Americans celebrate on July 4th, is not a concept that we give much thought to the rest of the year. And I'm not talking about expelling the British here. I am talking about living life without depending on somebody else to pull you along. You must become strong enough so you can go it alone if you have to. This codependent gibberish is destructive and promotes weakness. Obviously, we all need a support system, and that is the theme of this book. But sometimes such a system, for one reason or another, is not readily available. When that happens, it's up to you to forge ahead on your own. I learned this lesson in 1980. I was having a terrible time working at a TV station in Hartford, Connecticut. Nothing was going right, as my energetic style of presenting the news clashed with the 19th century approach favored by management. I mean, we should have been wearing powdered wigs on the set. I would be out there trying to engage the news viewer by delivering the copy with a snappy, urgent tone. Then they cut to my co-anchor, who was as stiff as Herman Munster. The result was disastrous, one guy reading quickly and the other somnambulant. Management quickly asked me to emulate Herman, possibly seeing me in the role of Eddie Munster. That, of course, was not the kind of career advice I was seeking, but once again, I had no one to provide perspective. I tried talking with my parents, but they seemed almost panicked at the prospect of giving their 30-year-old son vocational advice. My father's pithiest guidance was, "You can always go back to teaching." It was then that I realized my life was my responsibility and nobody else could get me through it. My folks loved me, but they simply couldn't deal with my circumstance. They each had their own problems. So I seized the day by not heeding the bad advice my bosses were peddling. I bailed out of Hartford after only 6 months. But shortly after that, armed with those snappy anchor segments, I was hired by WCBS-TV in the nation's largest market, New York City. When you become independent, you gain the freedom to work out dilemmas without having to rely on outside interference. This, in turn, raises the confidence level and helps you develop the skill of problem-solving that is vital in today's complicated society. The more I overcame life's difficulties on my own, the stronger I became mentally and the more clearly I saw things. That helped me form solid relationships with people who were willing to look out for me because they knew I was able to look out for them. My success in life began accelerating, although my ego still tripped me up from time to time. Along with developing independence, I started to flirt with tolerance. My upbringing in a working-class, all-white neighborhood had not encouraged that virtue. Outsiders were not immediately embraced in Levittown, which remains today one of the most segregated suburbs in the country. My own attitude, however, was never exclusionary. From my youngest days, I liked different kinds of people, especially those with strong points of view. But let's face it, most Americans are uneasy with the unfamiliar, and although we are a multicultural nation, not all of us are happy about it. But I recognize that in order to succeed big in journalism, I had to communicate with and to all kinds of different people. Thus, I began to study them, and it was fascinating. My biggest advantage in that department was that I was a dating bachelor for 25 years. I went out with all kinds of women, and most of them were very tolerant of me, even though I often didn't deserve it. That in turn taught me tolerance and also showed me that there is little difference in the basic attitudes of Americans, no matter what their ethnicity. Most will respond to a call for fairness. Most harbor no permanent ill will. My life has been greatly enriched because of all the different kinds of people I have dealt with. I cringe when I hear vicious generalizations about any race. So here's the end zone dance on this looking out for you business. First, you have to be willing to see yourself honestly. Then, you have to discipline yourself into cutting down on foolish mistakes. Along the way, you have to be willing to engage people whom you respect, but also be willing to accept rejection. Not everyone will become your friend, but some will. And those people will make a tremendous difference for the better in your life. Finally, stir into the mix a strong desire to develop your mind and protect your body from harm, while at the same time rewarding yourself with enjoyable times. Actively practice tolerance and build up your independent spirit. Shake things up once in a while with spontaneous fun, and you will have a recipe that will keep life interesting and mostly chaos-free. I've had a pretty good time in my life, despite being a jerk on more than a few occasions. I know I've got some good people looking out for me, but I also know that when my time comes, I'll leave the world by myself. And in the end, it won't matter much what President Bush did or what Bill Clinton did, or even what those closest to me did. Only what I did will matter. How did I look out for other people? How did I conduct myself in my short time on this earth? I fully expect to have to answer those questions to a higher power, but even if that's a myth, I still have to answer to myself. So, I think I'll continue to try to look out for as many people as I can, even though I concede that some may not see the method to my communicative madness. As one media analyst put it, quote, O'Reilly comes off like a jerk or a genius, depending on who you talk to, unquote. But I don't care about universal acceptance. The mass media are a tough game, and my approach is to lay it on the line and let the chips fall where they may, usually on somebody's head. That style is not for everyone, but in its own way, cutting through the fog is a noble endeavor. You deserve to have serious issues presented with clarity so that you can evaluate them without spin. You also deserve to have a good life free of malice and tragedy. That's not always possible, but it's a worthwhile goal. And lastly, you deserve to have good people on your side. My goal is to make the quest for those people somewhat easier. Above all, I hope I have looked out for you by writing this book. Thank you for listening to it. This is Bill O'Reilly. I hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Who's Looking Out for You. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Text copyright 2003 by Bill O'Reilly. Production copyright 2003, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.